You are listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Still ahead, as we work to manage this new coronavirus, we're thinking, do you trust the government? What about your neighbors? We'll look at how levels of trust and confidence around the world have contributed to success or failure in the face of a pandemic. First, people shared disinformation about a fake nationwide lockdown last month, and now U.S. officials say Chinese agents probably helped spread the message. It circulated so much that the White House's National Security Council called it out on Twitter as fake. The campaign is alarming some security experts because it reveals a new tactic, sending disinformation directly to Americans as text messages. You're part of this conversation. Did you get one of those messages? Maybe someone forwarded the warning to you. What did you do with the information when you saw it? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas at WPR.org. Christine Lee is an associate fellow at the Center for a New American Security's Asia-Pacific Security Program. Her research is focused on U.S.-China relations and Chinese and Russian disinformation, among other things. Christine, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Keely. Thanks so much for having me here with you today.
Certainly. Tell us about these fake messages about a nationwide lockdown that we saw last month. What would I have seen if I'd gotten one of the messages?
Sure. So preliminary analysis has shown that Chinese state actors, just zooming out a little bit, have sought to broadly sow confusion and spin narratives designed to taint the United States' response to the pandemic. And so in these particular messages that were sent out via text, we're seeing sort of a novel evolution of Chinese disinformation tactics. Both in the sense that, you know, they're leveraging a new platform that is, you know, directly pushing out false information to Americans through their cell phones. And secondly, that the messages are focused on sort of creating confusion and societal, eroding societal faith in democratic institutions. And so, these text messages were sort of riling up public fear about a nationwide lockdown with the deployment of military to prevent, you know, rioters and looters. And so it's been a really fascinating trend line to observe, and one in which, you know, we're seeing Chinese state actors adopt tactics that have traditionally been deployed more by Russian actors.
The messages, though, it sounds like did not originate with China, but China had a role in spreading them?
That's exactly right. And I think that it's a disinformation tactic that's becoming increasingly common in that state actors are sort of tracking conspiracy theory websites and social media accounts and amplifying pre-existing conspiracy theories through a number of different media, including through automated bots and trolls and through both American and Chinese social media accounts that ultimately belong to state actors.
President Trump was asked about China's disinformation campaign on Fox News last month. Here's a bit of what he said.
They do it and we do it and we call them different things.
I mean, that's a striking statement. Is he right? Do all countries do this and we just need to accept that?
I don't think that's an accurate assessment. What China's doing is fundamentally different from the narrative shaping that most other countries pursue, in that, authoritarian countries like China, their information space is entirely closed off to the rest of the world. And so the United States and China are operating on a fundamentally uneven playing field. Chinese state actors have complete access to American platforms, including Twitter, Facebook, and many other forms of media. But the United States obviously can't conduct the same operations within China's borders. And so I think, what we're seeing amid the pandemic is that Beijing is really moving to shape the global information environment in ways that are favorable to advancing its authoritarian aims.
So it sounds like then the end goal is a stronger China.
That's exactly right. And I think that the post-pandemic world will really sort of unveil a new era in U.S.-China competition.
Christine Lee is an associate fellow at the Center for a New American Security who specializes in Chinese and Russian disinformation. And we're talking about some text messages that then spread around to people about a fake lockdown last month. And some of the information that of this was being spread by text messages to Americans. And then we saw them, you know, seeing this, checking with family or friends, saying, did you get this, and spreading it that way. Do we know how widely then this fake information spread?
It's a good question. A lot of it is sort of dependent on the extent to which these messages were proliferating through social media applications and on social media sites. And the text messages appear to have gained traction on mainstream platforms like Facebook and Twitter. And so I think to the extent that the text messages were also being referenced on social media applications, they sort of created this mutually reinforcing feedback loop of fear and confusion about what was actually happening.
Why is it hard to try to monitor disinformation that's shared via text message or messaging apps that's different than how we see social media, for instance?
Sure. So I think, you know, that the way in which messages are conveyed on social media applications, there are ways in which the platforms can monitor information and flag it as being potentially suspicious and affiliated with a state actor. When those messages are being sent directly to people's phones, there isn't a simple way of tracking the sort of originating source of the messages. And so I think it's really a fascinating evolution in the way in which Chinese state actors are trying to get false information in the hands of individual Americans.
And certainly when the point is to confuse and provide disinformation, there isn't a label on it that says, you know, you shouldn't trust this. So what are some practical tips for people who may have encountered this disinformation or will in the future to kind of help us spot it?
Sure. So, I mean, you know, there are always general best practices when assessing information that's being transmitted through applications and through emails and through individual messages. You know, the first is, of course, being careful about downloading new applications in the first place. It's interesting to note that Beijing is becoming increasingly invested in sort of pushing out new social media applications, including, those that are very popular amongst young Americans like TikTok. And so I think just being careful about what you're downloading on the sort of Apple App Store. And of course, being very careful about clicking links that are transmitted through text messages and in emails. And I think what you're doing today is exactly right. It's, you know, educating the American public about new tactics that both Chinese and Russian state actors are leveraging to harvest data and to enable the spread of false information. And I think that a lot of the onus is on, not only state and local governments, but also the federal government to invest in educating the American public from a very young age about media literacy and about making informed decisions when it comes to information consumption.
So be a little skeptical of those text messages. Check with some reliable sources before you believe them.
Absolutely. Stay attuned to mainstream media and public discussion about disinformation that's occurring and will likely continue to occur as the pandemic continues on for the next several months.
Christine, thank you for sharing your expertise with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Christine Lee, a specialist in Chinese and Russian disinformation from the Center for a New American Security, with us today to talk about disinformation that was shared last month about a fake national lockdown in the U.S. and China's involvement in spreading that message. Coming up, we look at how trust in government and each other affects how effective responses to the coronavirus epidemic could be. Stay with us here on Central Time. You are listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. Coming up, we're talking about what to do when you're checking out at the grocery store and the person behind you is not following the 6 feet rule. An etiquette expert helps us navigate the uncomfortable moments that we are finding in this pandemic. First, different countries are using different strategies to deal with the coronavirus pandemic, and the results vary. Factors like the status of a nation's healthcare system, other infrastructure, and age and overall health of the population certainly play a role. Our next guest says levels of trust and distrust make a big difference, too. Mark Schrod is an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Villanova University. He received his PhD in political science from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and his areas of expertise include comparative politics, Russian politics, and international law. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You've written a piece for Foreign Policy looking broadly at how different countries are responding to this pandemic and how successful those different measures have been. And you key in on this issue of trust as a determining factor. What is it about trust?
I think it's one of many factors, but it seems to be the one that is just kind of hidden in plain sight. I think we do a lot of comparative politics in my classes. And usually the one I think that we all are kind of geared into when we're trying to differentiate between countries and their responses are the political ones, right? Are they democracy or dictatorship? That seems to be the usual one. But the places that seem to be doing the best in terms of, you know, balancing economic openness and so on are kind of a hodgepodge. They don't fit so much into that. Either they're all democracies and or all dictatorships. They're not all, you know, having, you know, these really hyper-developed, you know, welfare states or just the opposite. But it seems to be the countries that are doing the best are the ones with historically high levels of trust, not only trust in their government to deliver the goods, as it were, but also trust, societal trust, trust in one another. And I think that, you know, it seems to be just kind of staring us all in the face, but it's one of those things I think we need to work on, you know, getting past some of these partisan divisions, you know, and starting to develop our own, you know, senses of trust, because it's ultimately going to be one of those things that's going to help us on down the line.
Well, let's first look at trust in government from citizens. How have you seen that play out in a positive way with COVID-19?
I think, you know, again, when you see a lot of these statistics, because, you know, political scientists have been accruing data on this sort of stuff for years, you know, the places that seem to have, you know, flattened the curve fairly well seem to be the ones that have high trust in government. And so you're looking at places like South Korea, Taiwan, China historically has, you know, very large, you know, scores on trust in government. But also, you know, on the other side of the globe, you look at places like Iceland, which has sort of now flattened the curve quite a bit, and Sweden as well. That's, I guess, a more contentious issue if you want to get into the weeds on it. But it seems to be, you know, that this notion that, hey, we have trust not only in our government to do the right thing, but also trust in our leadership to follow the science. You know, to have policies that are well thought out because they know that they're going to be, you know, essentially responsible to the population at some point in time, whether that's elections or some other means.
Well, New Zealand is another place that we have seen, you know, really impressive response. There was a quick, decisive approach to the spread of the new coronavirus. It included shutting the border to people who weren't residents or citizens, also shut down most of the country. And here is Jacinda Ardern, who is the Prime Minister of New Zealand.
There is no widespread undetected community transmission in New Zealand. We have won that battle, but we must remain vigilant if we're to keep it that way.
Polls just this week saw Ardern's party's popularity, her own approval rating rising, showed that 78% of New Zealanders believe the country is headed in the right direction. It seems like that is a country that's got a lot of trust there.
Yeah, to be sure. And a lot of it is, you know, they're delivering the goods, right? I mean, they're showing, they're demonstrating to the population that we are in control. We do have an effective response. You know, we are effectively leading and you know, addressing these unforeseen circumstances, and are doing it in a way that, you know, that is broadly responsive, right? And so people seem to be, like I said, fairly responsive to that.
Mark Schrod is an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Villanova University, and we're talking about the role that trust plays in our fight against the new coronavirus. We've identified places where there's a lot of trust. What about the other side? What does response to the pandemic look like in countries where people don't trust the government very much?
Well, I think I guess ground zero for that is the United States. And it's something that a lot of people have been worried about for a long time and sort of been pointing out is, you know, look at this statistics on popularity, not only of you know, the executive branch, but of Congress, but of government more broadly. You know, we've been, you know, taught since we were very, very young, going back to the Reagan years and through the Clinton years and so on, that government is bad. Government can do no good. You know, the best government is a small government, and you know, politicians aren't to be trusted. And so we've kind of built this kind of calloused shell around ourselves that, you know, we're very cynical and we don't want to be duped because we don't want to be overly gullible and overly trusting. But I think in many cases, as Americans as a whole, we've kind of pushed off to the opposite end of that spectrum. We've gotten to the point where we're so cynical. We've gotten to the point where everything, you know, that's happening has to have some ulterior motive behind it. Well, it must be because somebody has something to gain for, you know, from this or from that. So we've become sort of this land of gullible cynics, you know, that we kind of throw up our hands and say, well, we don't know what's going on. And, you know, we don't, but somebody's got to be profiting from that. That seems to always be like one of the underlying arguments that gets tossed out. But I think we need to kind of maybe dial back some of the cynicism and say, hey, maybe, you know, when it comes to doing the right thing for the community, doing the right thing for one another, you know, there doesn't have to be an ulterior motive. There doesn't have to be a profit motive behind that. That's, you know, part of being a community. That's part of being a society, right? So, so that's hopefully, you know, my hope, knock on wood, that something positive comes out of this whole mess, is a little bit more understanding, a little bit more empathy, and a little bit less cynicism towards one another and towards the government.
Yeah, it doesn't help, though, when we have different states competing with different states for materials or protective equipment for healthcare workers. We've got the federal government sometimes stepping in and seizing orders that were going different places. So not only is there this overall challenge of trust, but there's also layers of trust and mistrust, you know, among smaller sections of people.
Exactly, exactly. And you know, ideally, you know, we would have a fully functioning, you know, sort of federal system that kind of works with this. You know, what we're witnessing now is kind of abdication of leadership at the federal level. And that's kind of relegated us to a situation which might be better described as a competitive confederacy. It's states going against states, out competing states for ventilators and for masks and so on, and competing against the federal government. And so this seems to be very pathological in its notion. And so in terms of what that means for trust, I think you see a lot more focus on, you know, who do you trust? Not, maybe not at the federal level, if you're looking at, you know, the Trump administration or at Congress, but at the state level, looking at your, you know, kind of the state by state decision makers, looking at governors, looking at their advisory boards, and determining which ones are, you know, trying to make decisions based on the common good and based upon science that can be empirically verified and therefore trusted. And who isn't, right? And so it's kind of in some ways really depressing to you know, to sort of recognize that you know, sort of basic questions of health and endurance going forward has a lot to depend upon, you know, who, whether or not, you know, the governor in the most recent election in your state happens to believe in science or not. And it's not always a narrowly partisan Democrat versus Republican thing. I mean, look at sort of Mike DeWine in Ohio, seems to be getting very high marks. A lot of it and building a lot of trust in government because he's delivering the goods and because he seems to be putting the welfare of his population first.
Well, let's take it way down then to the micro level. What about trust in communities among neighbors and people? What role do you see social trust or distrust playing as we deal with this pandemic?
Oh, that's a good one. Sure. I mean, you could look at I'm just trying to think of my own sort of anecdotal stuff out here in the Philadelphia suburbs. But, you know, checking in with each other, you know, people reconnecting with neighbors they haven't seen for a long time. You know, that sort of grassroots trust, you know, checking in on elderly neighbors. That's something that that could be a positive that comes out of this whole thing. But also we see, I think, on a daily basis, kind of the opposite of that, sort of that inherent distrust. I can think of no better indicator of distrust than or societal distrust than sort of, you know, buying up whole bunches of guns. Right. You know, you don't have to buy a whole, you know, arsenal of guns if you trust everybody around you. And you trust your neighbors to do the right things. And so that to me is just an indicator of a broader sense of distrust in our communities. But hopefully this is something, you know, this is, you know, maybe a bit of a timeout for us all to build our communities, to build our neighborhoods, to check in on those neighbors and those friends and to try to recognize that's, you know, one of the things that comes with trusting community is building community and recognizing that we're all very much in this together.
All right, Mark, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, no problem.
Mark Schrod is an associate professor of political science at Villanova University. And his third book is called Smashing the Liquor Machine, A Global History of Prohibition. Oxford University Press is publishing it this fall. And he was with us to discuss his recent article for Foreign Policy magazine titled The Secret to Coronavirus Success is Trust. You can find a link for that over at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up, we talk to an etiquette expert about how to navigate all of these awkward situations we're finding ourselves in. It's Central Time. Thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Voltina in for Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. Coming up on Monday after 7 o'clock on the morning show, the person leading Wisconsin's health department joins us for the state capitol report. Health Secretary designee Andrea Palm is talking about contact tracing, coronavirus testing, and public health. Join that conversation and more on Monday's The Morning Show from 6 until 9. Now, as of today, Wisconsin has more than 7,300 confirmed cases of COVID-19, and the percentage of positive tests is up. The contagious virus has changed how we live our lives, and that means we've also got a whole new set of social rules. We're encountering some sticky situations, so we called Elaine Swan. She's an etiquette expert and the founder of the Swan School of Protocol. Elaine, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, hello. Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Your big message right now is that we need to embrace the awkward. What do you mean by the awkward?
Oh my goodness. All of it is awkward. I mean, even right now, everything, whether you are allowed to actually go outside and take a walk down the street and someone is coming near you and you have to kind of cross over the other way, or maybe you're out, you know, collecting your groceries for the day and you see someone you know and you can't give that hug or, you know, not even a fist bump at this particular point in time, nothing. I mean, it's just very awkward. I mean, people that we know well and that we love, you know, we're shirking back from one another and recoiling a little bit and not necessarily being as physical with one another right now. And it's just plain awkward.
Yeah. So what do you do when someone comes in for a hug or a handshake and you know that you really aren't supposed to touch them right now? How do you say that?
Yeah, you do. Actually, two ways. There's two things we have to do in this particular instance. And number one, that's definitely use body language, because there's a UCLA study that says that 83% of communication is nonverbal. So use your body language so you can kind of put your hands up a little bit and say, hey, friend, you know, if you're really friendly with them, and make kind of an air kind of wave sort of thing to get them to stop. So you can use your body language that way. And then verbally, we have to be very, very verbal now and be very honest and very direct, yet at the same time, respectful. And hey, I'm not going to hug you. I just hey from afar. We got to make sure we're keeping that distance and keeping one another safe. And so it's really important for us right now to be very, very verbal. You know, a lot of times people think that etiquette means that you must either evade the truth or perhaps even, you know, not say things or be very demure about it. But no, my advice always is that with etiquette, you can say anything to anybody. It just depends on how you say it.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So we heard from Stephanie at the Ideas Network Facebook page, who says she asked for space from someone not wearing a mask in line at a grocery store the other day. Stephanie said she followed up by saying how hard it is to get used to this all, and it seemed to neutralize a little bit of tension. So what are ways that we can use the language, say what we want to say, but do it in a respectful way someplace like the grocery store?
Sure. Yeah. One of the things that we can do is make it more so about us. Whatever you say, make it about us and we, so that this way it doesn't seem as though you're pointing the finger at the person and telling them you are doing this wrong and don't you do that. So instead, very similar to what your listener said, you know, make it about us or we. So you can say, you know, I think it's important for us to make sure that we're really taking care of one another right now. So let's put some space in between us as we're standing waiting in this line. And then yes, take the conversation in a direction to where, you know, you really pivot and start to talk about how it's kind of affecting, and maybe even ask the person, how are you doing? Isn't this difficult? Is it hard to adjust? How's your family? That sort of thing. So really, rather than pointing the finger, make your conversation more about what we're all going through at the same time. And I think that kind of takes away that sting of frustration that we're all experiencing.
All right. Elaine Swan is an etiquette expert and the founder of the Swan School of Protocol. We are talking about the kind of new rules of politeness and social responsibility we have as we navigate a world trying to get a handle on this new coronavirus. And you're part of this conversation. We have a line for you at 800-642-1234. Let us know about one of the awkward situations maybe you have encountered. What do you do when you see someone who's not social distancing? What approach do you take? 800-642-1234. Maybe you've been on the other end of this, that somebody's called you out for not following all of the social distancing recommendations that we have. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We also have Twitter at Central Time, WPR. And it does get challenging as we are trying to navigate this, because we do have CDC recommendations that ask people to wear masks. And sometimes it can be difficult because it feels like you might think that someone is worried that you're sick because they're wearing a mask. But it's also hard to explain when you're wearing it that it is about you and that you're trying not to spread any germs to other people. We also have this rule to try to stay 6 feet away from one another, and that can be really difficult, especially if you do go on a grocery run, even if they have the stickers on the floor to obviously social distance the people in front of you. You can kind of offer some space, but behind you, it is more difficult. So we do know we are encountering these more awkward conversations, and Elaine Swan is here to talk with us about it. Share your questions at 800-642-1234. And Elaine, what if it doesn't affect you immediately personally, but say your neighbors are having a party next door? What do you do? What is appropriate at that point?
Yeah, so this is a tough one here. It's not necessarily tough, but there's two things that you can do. It is actually affecting you, and that's where we have to really kind of gauge certain things. If it's affecting you and maybe people are spilling over into your area and you know, you feel it's unsafe for your family, my advice is to speak directly with your neighbor as opposed to any of the guests. I mean, our neighbors, we see them, they'll recognize us. So if there's any sort of way that you can get in contact with your neighbor to let them know that maybe if they can keep it over there, or that folks are kind of, you know,
know, spilling into your area or what have you, if it's affecting you personally, you definitely have every right to ask your neighbor to corral their guest so that it does not impede you or put your family in any harm. Now, if it's not, and they are just disobeying, disobeying the rules, you know, and not following along, and you are concerned for some future things, I say to use authority figures to kind of get things across. And that's one of the things that I write in my book, which is called Let Crazy Be Crazy. My advice is to use authority figures. So rather than trying to kind of police your neighbors, instead allow the authorities to do it. That means if there's a lot of counties and cities have a hotline where you can call or email to report any activity that people are you know, displaying that's going against what the guidelines are, my advice is to utilize those systems and processes that are in place as opposed to, you know, becoming very confrontational with your neighbor. Because when this is all over, we do still have to dwell together in peace. And so if you can approach them in a peaceful manner directly and ask them to kind of keep it over there and keep it away from your family. But if it's out of control and it really seems as though people are really in danger, then my advice is to use authority figures and utilize those hotlines and email addresses that are available to report that type of activity.
Sure, because this isn't like we're witnessing someone breaking into a house. I mean, these are recommendations, and certainly they are enforceable. And this is not criminal activity if you're gathering together at another person's apartment and if you think that that's what's happening there, because we don't have all the information either, which makes it more difficult.
Sure, it does, because, you know, you never know. I mean, just in today's climate, you have multi-generational family members living in one house just because. You might have college students who have come back home from you know, college, and so the household itself could just have more people dwelling there at this particular point in time than normal. And so although it may seem as though there's a party, like you said, we don't know the whole story. And so that's why it's so important to first connect with your neighbor. If it's bothering you, and that's the thing about it, we don't want to be kind of like Gladys Kravitz on Bewitched, you know, and, you know, always looking and trying to police other people. If it's affecting you, definitely connect with your neighbor and talk with them about it. If it seems as though it's a clear breach of the guidelines that are recommended, then utilize the resources that are available. Now, I'm not saying call the cops. But there are definitely, every city and every county has put out non-emergency numbers and created websites and email addresses to share that information. And so that's what I would do in that instance.
All right. We're talking to Elaine Swan, an etiquette expert and the founder of the Swan School of Protocol, with us today to talk about some of those awkward situations we're finding ourselves in during the pandemic. And you're part of this conversation. Join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us about an awkward situation you found yourself in. Maybe you have had to speak up because someone wasn't social distancing and it was going to affect you. Or maybe you've been on the other end of this. Somebody said something to you because they didn't think you were following all of the right social distancing rules. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. There's a line for you now in this conversation. It continues here on Central Time after the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina, and we are talking about good etiquette during the coronavirus pandemic. Elaine Swan is with us. She's an etiquette expert, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Tell us about some of the sticky situations you've been trying to figure out how to approach. Maybe you found something that works for you when someone tries to hug you or shake your hand. Give us some advice at 800-642-1234, or you can get some of that, too. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Danny on Facebook says, if you're on an 8-foot-wide bike path, don't walk or bike in the middle of it. Goodness, what do you think good etiquette is for exercising outside, Elaine?
You know, I think we have to kind of almost follow the rules of the road. I mean, we, you know, typically when we're driving here in the U.S., we, you know, drive on the right and then other cars, you know, will pass on the left. So if we're out, if you're on a bike path or if you're on the beach or walking down the street or what have you, stay to the right and give people some space to either pass you going one direction or the other. I think it's really important for us to really, it's so important in this particular instance to not just protect ourselves. I mean, we have our face coverings on and we have this. I mean, I live in California, and as of today, we're required to wear a face covering in public. That's what's required. But we have to just really make sure that we're being aware of other people. You know, are we impeding on someone else's space? You know, the three core values of etiquette that I talk about often are respect, honesty, and consideration. And in this instance, we have to be respectful of all of the guidelines that have been put in place. And then we have to be considerate of other people. So, you know, going down that path, you know, straight in the middle really is quite inconsiderate. And we really have to think about our fellow neighbors in this particular instance.
Well, even sidewalks, they're much narrower than something like an 8-foot-wide bike path. And I could see a circumstance where you're pushing a stroller or you use a wheelchair and it's not easy for you to, you know, hop off into the grass or get into the street. I mean, how do you ask the person coming straight at you to give you a little bit of space?
You know what? You know, it's hard to control other people. And that's another thing I put in my book, Let Crazy Be Crazy. You cannot fix people, right? You can't control other people. But what we can do is control ourselves. So if you see a person that's coming, you know, they might have their earbuds in. They might, you know, be completely distracted. I would say instead of trying to get them to understand your body language or hear what you're saying, just stop. Move yourself to one side or the other as best as you can. Allow that crazy to pass by, and then you keep on going and move on with yourself. But I say, you know, don't try to, you know, if it's not someone you know and they don't know you and they don't know how you communicate, don't even get into that dance. Instead, do your best to kind of stop and allow them to pass by and then move forward.
All right. And we are taking calls at 800-642-1234. And Mike from Antico is on the line now. Hi, Mike.
Hello. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly. What's your question?
I had a question about maybe second homes. People with second homes in an area outside of maybe a larger city where, you know, people are coming from a big city to their vacation home and how that may impact the other people. Just wanted to curious about your thoughts on that.
Interesting. Okay, Elaine, so there's that first layer of, you know, should you go there? Is that proper etiquette at this stage if the state allows it? And then there's also the idea of if you know somebody who's going to head up to the lake house or something, do you speak up about that?
Yeah, well, you know, it just really depends on whether or not it's permitted. There are some communities who have said that we do not want, even if you do own a, you know, home here in this area, there are some communities who have said we don't want anyone from the city coming into the area just because they want to try to keep it safe. And so my advice is to definitely follow those guidelines. Now, if in fact you are able to go to that second home, it's important to still really make sure that you're following the guidelines that are governing that area, whether it be your state, you know, the city, the county, the local area. Don't feel as though because you are at your second home that now you're, you know, somewhat immune to everything that's going on and you don't have to follow those guidelines. So I think it's important to just whatever the guidelines that are set that have jurisdiction over that particular area, then follow those.
You know, Elaine, I'm not going to lie. I like a good opportunity to judge, but it does seem like right now we should be presuming that people are just trying their best to follow the rules. Is that a fair outlook?
I think so. I mean, when you look at the news or you read the news or you listen to it on television or what have you, it seems as though for the most part, you know, many people just want this to be over with. And so they're doing, you know, individual people are doing their part to just stay within those guidelines. I mean, it's like going to a stoplight in the middle of the night. You know, the stoplight says, you know, you're supposed to stop, but you know, your moral compass directs you on whether or not you're going to stop and follow the guidelines or stop sign, you know, or either barrel through that. Most people are going to go ahead and stop because that's the right thing to do. Now, you are going to have some individuals that'll barrel through it just because no one's looking. And I think in every society, you have those folks that kind of go about things in that no one's looking kind of way. But I think people are trying to do the right thing.
Elaine Swan is an etiquette expert and the founder of the Swan School of Protocol. And we're talking about the new rules of politeness and social responsibility as we navigate the spread of the new coronavirus. And there's still time for your call at 800-642-1234. You can let us know about a situation you've handled, or maybe if you've got a question about one that is arising in your life, you can get in on it by calling 800-642-1234. Elaine, what about handling someone who may be approaching us? Maybe somebody is being aggressive or rude to us because they don't think we're following the rules. How can we respond in a way that is appropriate?
Yeah, so whenever someone, you know, comes at you and they are maybe a little bit, like you said, maybe they're a little rude, or perhaps they are somewhat aggressive, I always say that a soft answer turns away wrath. And so rather than coming right back at that person in an incredibly aggressive manner, instead, if, let's say, for example, you know, maybe you were rustling and you know, your hands were full and your mask came down and someone says, you need to have your mask on, they caught you right in that moment, you can say, yep, we all have to make sure that, you know, I'm with you there. It fell down and I'm right on top of it, or something like that. I mean, the thing is, do your best to try to diffuse any conflict so that that way it doesn't, you know, grow into anything else if someone does come at you. And if you happen to say something to someone and for example, asking them to step out of your space and they say, no, I'm in a hurry, mind your business, I'm going to do what I want to do, then again, you just let crazy be crazy and leave them alone. It's in that moment that you can step back and allow that person to do whatever they have to do, and then you get into it. Because what we're looking at here is something, we're not just looking at politeness, but we're also looking at the fact that this is a health crisis. And so we don't know what's happening. We don't know who has been impacted in what manner by, you know, by this virus. And so if you stay wrong and strong and you say, I'm going to stand my ground because I was here first, and perhaps the person next to you, you know, maybe they're sick or they're just getting over it, or they're asymptomatic, you could really be harmed. So why put yourself in harm's way when you can take one moment to just step back, or take one moment to just say, you know what, fine, my mask came down and I'm getting it back up. Good day to you. Wishing you all the best. Soft answer turns away wrath.
That can be really difficult, though, because sometimes you just want to explain, I know, I've been trying really hard, I swear.
It can be, yeah. And that's where self-control comes in, you know. We want to, but really, you know, we're never going to see the person again, probably, so who cares what they think, you know?
Right. So it sounds then that you think there's a real place for, you know, humility right now, and remembering that we all make mistakes and, you know, we're all just trying to figure it out.
Yes. And that's the thing. Every day this thing changes. Every day there's something new. Every day there's something we're doing or we're not doing or we're not supposed to do. It's difficult to figure it out. And so, yes, humility in this particular instance is important to have. Politeness, but firm. We have to be firm and we have to be direct and we have to speak up for ourselves, but recognize when you need to just take a step back. And just let things move forward in its way. We don't always, there's a difference between knowing you are right and proving you are right. It takes way more time to prove to somebody that you are right than to just in your own head know that you are correct in what you were doing. It was just an accident and I will probably never see you again. You know, that's way less energy.
Absolutely. Before we let you go, things are kind of stressful right now. I mean, what's your best piece of advice for somebody to try to stay calm then?
Yeah, so my best piece of advice right now is to really put forth the greatest effort to, number one, think before you speak, think before you act, and always put yourself in the other person's shoes. You never know what someone is going through.
All right.
Someone
Yes, Elaine, I'm sorry. We'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us. That was Elaine Swan, an etiquette expert with the Swan School of Protocol. And you heard this conversation right here on Central Time, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. And we'll also have more of these conversations coming up on Monday related to COVID-19. And you can find the latest at WPR.org/COVID. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show, coming up Monday after 8. We are talking about the food supply. We'll discuss why some farmers are dumping milk despite increased need for nutritious options at food pantries. And we'll talk about commodity markets and oversupply and USDA policy. That's Monday on The Morning Show, right here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, we've got news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. And then we talk with renowned chef and public TV host Lydia Bastianich about how cooking can help us get through these difficult times and how to put together a great Italian dish with just a few ingredients. Thanks for joining us. I'm Keeley Boltina, and this is Central Time.